I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. Much of the world believed NATO lies that the Washington proxy war on Russia through Ukraine was unprovoked, that 9/11 was something to do with Afghanistan, that there was WMD in Iraq, and that destroying Libya was moral. Today, most of humanity is in no doubt that genocide in Jerusalem and Gaza has been enabled by the USA and its puppet Western European nations. It will be on show on Wednesday when Israelis celebrate the illegal annexation of East Jerusalem. With the mask off the Washington rules-based order and Russia, China, the Global South, all economically, politically and strategically, now pursuing paths independent of NATO nations, is it now the beginning of the end of Israel? Just as Biden and Trump fight over who is the figurehead for the beginning of the end of U.S. empire. Mikko Peled, the founder of Palestine House of Freedom and author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, fought for Israeli special forces before becoming a powerful voice for peace. He joins me again from Washington, D.C. Mikko, so good to see you again. I better first ask you about House of Palestine. What is this new initiative?
Palestine House of Freedom, Dar al-Hurriya, as we call it in Arabic. It's an initiative to, first of all, have a space in Washington, D.C., a central high-profile place in Washington, D.C. that carries the Palestinian flag. There hasn't been a Palestinian flag in Washington, D.C., and it's high time. So the symbolism is important. And then we're working to make sure that the content inside the building, which is quite a substantial space that we have, functions to change the narrative and to change the conversation in Washington, D.C. from a very pro-Zionist, between pro to liberal Zionist conversation discourse to a discourse that calls for the dismantling of apartheid and the establishment of a real democracy between the river and the sea with equal rights.
I know.
That's our main mission.
I mean, amidst all the carnage that we can see on our social media and not on the NATO nation propaganda media, You have been hugely enthused by the protests across campuses right across the United States. But if you have this House of Palestine, I mean, you don't think the U.S. security forces will target it like it targeted the students at the campuses in Georgetown?
Well, who knows what the other side is going to do? I mean, we need to do what we need to do. I think the student initiatives have always raised the level of discourse about Palestine in this country far above and beyond anybody would have expected, and more than anybody else has. And I think they've contributed to the struggle to free Palestine more than anyone in this country. There was a fantastic conference, the People's Conference for Palestine in Detroit, which came out of that student movement, and it was attended by thousands. And anybody who was there agreed it was the best event conference for Palestine ever held. And so our part in this entire strategy is, if you will, to take the plug and put it in the socket. In other words, we're in the Capitol. We are a stone's throw from the Capitol, and we need to enter those spaces where decisions are being made, these insulated areas, insulated spaces that we're not being heard. I mean, we can have a million people in the streets, and then they're still selling weapons and allowing this genocide, this horrific massacre to continue. So I see our responsibility as the people who care for justice and freedom, you know, to figure out a way to enter those spaces and push this agenda forward, again demanding the dismantling of apartheid and the establishing of a real free Palestine, a democratic state from the river to the sea.
I mean, Congress obviously doesn't matter, but do you think you can draw a connection between, say, the campus protests and initiatives like that with the bizarre moment in history where Biden appeared to be saying a 2,000-pound bomb shouldn't be sent to Netanyahu? I don't know whether more was sent in any case, because $1 billion of more weapons have been signed off from American public money to Israel in any case. But just that little mention of the fact that one bomb had not been sent to Israel, part of trying to please the base?
Probably. I mean, there's a lot of pressure in the Democratic Party. There's a lot of pressure. I mean, the Democratic convention is coming up, and I think the city of Chicago is going to be a repeat of history. It's going to be complete chaos. People are demanding change. People are demanding recognizing that there's an apartheid, the crime of apartheid is being perpetrated, and the crime of genocide is being perpetrated, and they want to see their leaders respond. So sadly, the response so far has been so completely, you know, pale and ineffective. You know, the best they can do is, like you say, deny a single particular bomb. But I mean, they're allowing this bloodletting, this vicious massacre, this vicious genocide, this sadistic, I mean, I don't, you know, the words fail you sometimes, to go on in broad daylight. And the thing is, the conversation has to change. There has to be a tipping point. We have to bring it to a tipping point where people discuss the end of apartheid and the establishment of a free Palestine from the river to the sea as mainstream. What was interesting at the conference, the People's Conference on Palestine just recently in Detroit, was that that was the mainstream. We had thousands of participants that were there, some of the most brilliant young speakers, many of them were up until this point and outside of that circle, completely unknown. Many were known, but many were unknown. And that was the mainstream. That was the discussion. And I've been to several of these student encampments here across the United States. And the conversation is the same. Divest, divest. They're demanding their campuses divest. Divestment is a step in the dismantling of apartheid. So it's a recognition of apartheid and a demand for a free Palestine from the river to the sea. This is what these students are demanding. And they're not going anywhere.
And that's more important than, I know audience figures are down, but Rupert Murdoch's Fox News channel repeatedly claiming if you're in any way in support of Palestine, you are pro-Hamas, pro-October the 7th resistance attack. And as you know, the Congress is unanimous in its support for Israel. Except Ilhan Omar, I suppose.
I don't see any problem with either one of those two statements. I mean, the Palestinian resistance is a legitimate form of resistance. The attacks of the Palestinian resistance operation on October 7th was a brilliantly executed operation.
Yeah, sorry, Miko, I didn't mean it in that way. I meant they seem to equate in their lexicon, they see October the 7th as something on the side of ISIS Daesh, which, of course, many people have written about as being a CIA cutout operation.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they're going to say what they're going to say, but eventually, and we know this because we've been around long enough, that those who called Nelson Mandela a terrorist then went, you know, begging for an audience with him when he was president and wanted to shake his hand. That's how history seems to turn. And this is exactly what's going to happen now. And I believe very strongly that if these initiatives continue, if the student initiatives continue, if our Palestine House of Freedom, we do our work, then this is going to be the tipping point, and this conversation is going to change very quickly here in Washington, D.C., which is where most decisions are being made about, like you said, most of the decisions about Palestine are being made here, you know, at the Capitol and in the White House. So I really believe that is, you know, whatever they claim now is irrelevant, because they're going to change their tune once things turn around. There's no question about that.
Yeah, and as corporate media and corporate board politicians slowly begin to change a little and realize, or maybe admit, what they knew anyway, that genocide was taking place. Do you think there's a greater recognition that, I mean, if Israel, to use mental illness as a way to talk about it, founded after the Holocaust in Europe, it's the selling of the arms, it's the sending of the weapons that is enabling this. They're just going to end up blaming Israel, as we can see from certain Western European countries proudly going, it's Israel that's evil. It's not just Israel, is it, by any means?
No, of course not. I mean, Americans, Brits, I mean, they all receive a Zionist education. So, you know, on both sides of the Atlantic, people grow up being Zionists, even if they don't know, even if they can't articulate, you know, what Zionism exactly means. They are Zionists. The education system here trains people, leads people to be Zionists. There's no question about it. You know, they know everything about the Holocaust. They know everything about the biblical stories. They know everything about the Jews and so on and so forth. They know nothing about Palestine.
You mean from Hollywood to novels to the whole
exactly
cultural
and in textbooks and in textbooks. There are Zionist organizations across every state here in the United States that examine the textbooks. And when the teachers have their social studies conferences and so forth, they are there with a curriculum providing, you know, curricula for these teachers that then they teach their students. So it's in the schools, it's in the culture, like you said, it's in the movies, it's everywhere. It's in the news, of course, and in the politics. So Americans grow up being Zionists, and that is a big challenge. Of course, they've been at this for 100 years, pushing this agenda forward. And so once you get to that point where people on the streets are already Zionists, it's very easy to justify sending weapons to the only Jewish state, you know, and the people who came back from the Holocaust and so on and so forth, that entire narrative. It's very easy to do that. Of course, it's not just Israel, but I'd be quite happy with Israel, with the apartheid being dismantled.
Well, let me get on to that. Let me get on to that. I mean, your grandfather famously was one of the 37 who signed off the creation of Israel. Do you think now we are watching the beginning of the end of Israel?
I think, you know, Ilan Pappa said this quite eloquently recently as a historian.
People can watch our interview with him recently.
And so exactly. So he said very articulately, this is, as a historian, he believes that the honest historians will in the future talk about this period as, you know, the first signs of the decline of Zionism. And you know, I don't know if I'm that optimistic. I do think that the potential is there. I think the potential for the end of Zionism is there, and the recognition around the world that Zionism, that there should be zero tolerance to Zionism because it is a racist, genocidal ideology that produced a racist, genocidal state. So I think if we do our job as people of conscience around the world, then we will see an end to this very sad chapter in the history of Palestine, and there will, again, it'll collapse and a real free Palestine will emerge after it and replace it. But I think a lot of it depends on what we do and whether or not we do our job, you know, fast, because we don't want to waste any more time.
Are we seeing the end of the phrase, the two-state solution, which some maintain is an excuse for the genocide? That's what leaders of countries say to excuse genocide?
Well, yeah, it's a fig leaf. Sadly, no, that's exactly the problem. We have not seen the end of that phrase. We still see the Bernie Sanders types of liberal Zionists talk about the two-state solution and so forth. And that's, again, precisely what our mission needs to be, as Dar al-Hurriya, is to provide them with a context so people understand that why that is absurd, why the notion of separating Palestine is absurd, why historically, realistically, it cannot be done, and historically, it's not the right thing to do, and politically, it's an impossibility. So our role is to educate the people around these figures to make sure that they understand why they can no longer say this, why it's unacceptable, because the two-state solution legitimizes Zionism. It legitimizes everything that happened from 1947 until 1967, as though 1967 was different than what happened before that. You know, we're approaching on the anniversary of the 1967 Israeli assault on its neighbors in June of 1967, in which, as you know, my father was one of the generals. So to educate the people, to give them the context to understand and to see and to explain, and again, to push forward why the two-state solution is absolutely the wrong thing to talk about. It's absurd. It is immoral. It leads to nothing, and it really provides, like you say, provides a fig leaf to the ongoing genocide. Whereas, and again, I don't even know what the benefits or what the virtue of that would be, even if it was possible. Whereas a single democracy between the river and the sea, and anybody who doesn't like the phrase "the river and the sea," you know, that's where Palestine is. I don't know what other place Palestine is if not between the river and the sea. But between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean, a real democracy, a real free Palestine with equal rights, that should be the conversation. That's what we're pushing for.
Miko Peled, I'll stop you there. More from the grandson of a signatory to Israel's 1948 creation after this break.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns. Here, we discuss some real news.
On March the 22nd, 1943, during the Great Patriotic War, the Schutzenmannschaft Battalion 118 burned down the Belarusian village of Khatyn.
Мы на улице играли, а потом пришли, победили, вышли на улицу и начали стрелять. Как начали стрелять, так у нас тут это кругом пули летели.
149 people died, including 75 children. The village was practically wiped off the face of the earth.
Пламя было, зарево было. Очень кричали, плакали. Но люди были порасползавшие. Вот, горело. А живые там никто не остался.
The infamous battalion responsible for the atrocity included over 100 Ukrainian nationalists from Western Ukraine.
И когда я прочитал и увидел, что это были украинцы, и там все были украинцы и по рождению, и по национальности, я спросил у нее, а почему нам об этом не рассказывают нигде никогда?
Declassified criminal cases from the Central Archive of the KGB of Belarus shed light on the atrocity and answer numerous questions that have remained unanswered for many years. Watch on RT.
Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Miko Peled, the grandson of a signatory to Israel's 1948 creation. Miko, we were talking about perhaps the end of Israel as we know it. How are people in Israel reacting to ongoing events? Previously, they, well, one Labour Party chief in Israel, Merav Mishlo, said Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir, the people in power in Tel Aviv right now, helped assassinate Rabin. How close is Netanyahu to assassination?
Well, I think I don't think he's close to assassination at all. I think he's doing exactly what his constituents want him to do.
Or do they want more?
Well, I'm sure they would. I don't know what more could he possibly do. He's massacring people as much as humanly I think possible. And so I think he's doing exactly what people want. The only people who oppose him are people that want his seat. But it's not for political or ideological reasons. I mean, the Israeli society, by and large, stands behind the genocide. They've always stood behind the genocide. I mean, it's been going on since Israel was established, and the vast majority of Israeli society always stood behind it. There is some kind of, I think, a sickness that exists in racist genocidal societies, especially some of the societies that are raised and brought up and educated to be racist and genocidal. Israelis are certainly not the first. Hopefully, they'll be the last. But that is the reality. And I think Netanyahu seems to be politically at least very, very safe. And he's doing exactly what his constituents want.
You say it couldn't be worse or it's difficult to see it. But of course, as you know, in Washington, we've had Lindsey Graham, senior senator. We've had one leader in Michigan talking about the use of nuclear weapons to destroy Gaza, even though there have been multiples of Hiroshima's of TNT dropped on. Of British, American, EU nation weaponry onto Gaza. How will Israel react as it seemingly loses this war against Hamas or some members of the resistance who are clearly surviving while the women and children and civilians, men, are being slaughtered?
I don't think Israel's objective is to defeat the Palestinian resistance. I think Israel's objective is to kill as many Palestinians as possible. And in that, they've been very successful. So when people say Israel is losing on that front, I have to question that because the objective is not to defeat the resistance. I don't think anybody thinks it's even a realistic expectation that will ever happen.
So it's extermination.
But it's extermination. It's genocide. It's a Holocaust. They want to execute a complete Holocaust against the Palestinian people. And they're doing it, as we can see, without any interruption.
You don't see any element here of Israel being used by certain people in the right in the United States for trying to get a wider war with Iran. They're clearly failing, given new alliances being forged here in West Asia between Saudi Arabia and Iran and Syria and so forth. Did it surprise you, Iran's response, calibrated response to the attack on the consulate in Damascus and the way that this region is not being provoked by the horrific imagery into the wider war?
Yeah, I don't think Israel is being used. I think Israel is doing exactly what it was always doing and it wants to do, which is, again, eliminate the Palestinian people. As to the Iranian response, it's always been measured. It's always been responsive. They've always been responsible in their responses to the Israeli provocation, and they continue, thankfully, to do that. So I don't think I think maybe there are people who want to see some kind of a glorious destruction of the entire region. But I think the important thing is to focus on ending the genocide of the Palestinian people by dismantling the regime, dismantling apartheid, You know, just as an example, we talk about sanctions and divestments and so forth. FIFA just had their Congress in Thailand a couple of weeks ago. There's all these kind of, you know, behind the scenes conversations about kicking out Israel. I don't know what they're waiting for. What more does Israel need to do before it's kicked out of all these organizations, these athletic organizations? This is, to me, you know, one of the bigger problems is there's not enough pressure on these organizations to kick Israel out.
But do they only just matter as a sort of PR influence at elections, rather like this International Caucasian Court, it was called, until recently? I mean, the response after the court was talking about genocide and Rafah was to give Israel another month to carry it out. Is this all just mood music, but doesn't really help the actual resistance? Because we see the pictures of what happens every time these judges speak, more children are killed.
You know, it reminds me, it makes me think of, you know, when Hitler was massacring Jews, you know, can you imagine somebody saying you have 1 month to show us that you're going to stop, or asking for a ceasefire? I mean, this is absurd. It's an absolutely kind of a absurd theater. Why are they waiting for them? Why are they giving them more time? Why are they giving them the option to negotiate a ceasefire? When there's a genocide going on, you come in and you end it. The Sixth Fleet, the U.S. Navy's Sixth Fleet, is in the Mediterranean. They can stop it right now. They could have prevented all of this and provide this urgent humanitarian care to the Palestinians in Gaza and open the gates. I mean, the only reason there's a humanitarian crisis in Gaza is because it's a prison. People are bringing, you know, thousands of trucks stuck in Rafah in Egypt, instead of opening the gates and letting people go into 1948 Palestine, where there's all the food, all the water, all the medical care they could possibly want, a 10-minute drive away. You know, the conversation is so ridiculously skewed. And then again, instead of asking Israel to agree to a ceasefire and giving them another month to prove this, end it now so that Palestinians are not killed anymore. Open the goddamn gates, destroy this prison, lift the siege, let people live. But no, Israel has to be given all these. And again, can you imagine when Hitler was in power doing that, giving him all these, you know, giving him all these opportunities to continue to kill as the killing goes on? There's not even a pause in the killing of people and this horrific suffering and this entire sadistic reality that we see in front of our very eyes. A 10-minute drive east, any point in the Gaza Strip, there's water, there's food, there's medical care, the best medical care. We can, you know, Palestinians don't need to suffer. There's no reason whatsoever for them to suffer. Open the goddamn gates and eliminate the apartheid. That's the key here. But that's the last thing people want to talk about.
But do you think Egypt has a role here? Can just explain the situation there for those people who have not been to the region, to Gaza, to that border, this fake name, Philadelphia Corridor, just thought up by the Israelis. Can the Egyptians not just open their border with Gaza instead of all this blame of Israel?
There's nothing there on the other side. Rafah has, what's on the other side? Desert. The other side of Rafah is a desert, is a Sinai desert. There's nothing there. You know, a 10-minute drive east, there's like, you know, an entire country, a developed country with hospitals and cities and towns everywhere. I mean, a 10-minute drive east out of the Gaza Strip, out of any point, you know, there'll be the end to all this horrific suffering. Opening Rafah is okay, but there's nothing on the other end. It's a desert. It's a desert and refugee camp.
And that's seen as facilitating the expulsion and forcible removal of all these 2 million people from Gaza and just leaving them to be stranded like they are in Sabra and Shatila. But why is it there hasn't been more international resistance attacks in solidarity? What is the, I mean, clearly the, I suppose you'd say that the Fatah PLO leadership is completely discredited, but why is it we're not seeing this conflict widen at all and just this enclosed area of 2 million people being starved to death or bombed to death without any other resistance, violent resistance, as I suppose Mandela would have advocated during the apartheid struggle abroad as well as at home?
Well, I know Israeli settlements in another part of the country are completely paralyzed because of the attacks by the Lebanese by Hezbollah. So they're paying a heavy price, and they're paying a heavy price in the north for this. But look, I mean, Palestinians are doing everything they possibly can. Palestinians exist in a maximum security prison, and so they're doing everything they possibly can. There's Jenin, there's Nablus, the northern West Bank, and many other forms of resistance the Palestinians use that are unarmed. But I, you know, the emphasis needs to be on us. I mean, I think the help is going to come from the outside. You know, you mentioned Mandela in South Africa. They had the Soviet bloc, they had the non-aligned countries, they had Cuba sending tanks to Angola. You know, we don't live in that world anymore, where there's somebody who can support the free, you know, justice and liberation in Palestine. So it's up to us, people of conscience, just anywhere around the world, to stand up and demand that our governments do the right thing. And they're not going to do the right thing unless we force them to do it. And so
which they won't, as regards who's going to win the election in the US in November. Both sides are bankrolled by supporters of Israel, so that won't have much effect. And there's an immense amount of money to be made out of burning babies and beheading babies, as Britain, the United States, and EU nation weaponry is causing. It'll be slow, this grassroots action, to take effect. By then, rather like the ICJ way of trying to stop this, won't they all be killed?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, things are moving way too slow, of course. And you know, you start something and you don't know how long it's going to take. But and yeah, I mean, it's a horrific situation where you see this horrific bloodletting take place, and the best thing you can do is hope to get him, start a campaign, start a protest, organize a sit-in, and so on. It's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying. But you're right, these things are going to be the process is very, very slow. The hope is that if enough players participate and enough organizations participate and enough countries take part in this, and there's enough pressure, that every little piece of pressure, bit of pressure, eventually will bring it to collapse.
And
So it's not going to be.
just finally, on that optimistic note, although, as you say, it is slow, is it the end of any moral authority from NATO propaganda media? I don't know what you've thought. I mean, you're probably too busy organizing and trying to prevent the genocide to watch, who knows. But CNN, BBC, Comcast, Sky News, if you've been watching their coverage, is it the end of any kind of moral authority from these sorts of media organizations? The New York Times, of course, which printed the fake stories of sexual crimes being systematically perpetrated by resistance groups. Is it the end? Is this war the end of that kind of media as being having any respect?
Well, I don't know that they have any respect, or that I don't know they ever had any moral authority. Anybody who has a little bit more of an analytic perspective realizes that there's never been any moral stance held by these people. But you know, my problem is that it's not just that. You know, it's that other countries are still maintaining good relations with Israel. I mean, they might say something, but like most of the BRICS countries are still have good relations with Israel. Not all, they haven't all downgraded or closed their embassies and kicked out the Israeli ambassadors. I mean, you'd expect that would be perhaps some kind of a response, but that's slow to take place. And so, I have little expectation from the NATO countries. I have more expectation from the African countries, the Asian countries, the BRICS alliance, if you will, to be the counter, to be, to take the place of what used to be, again, the Soviet bloc and so on, that stood with nations that were fighting for liberation. And that's not there yet. I'm hoping that it will be. But I think we have to have hope. We have to be optimistic. I mean, Palestinians are looking at what is happening on campuses around the world, Palestinians in Gaza, and they're realizing that somebody is standing with them, even with all the hardship that they're suffering.
Mikko Pallett.
Hardship.
Mikko Pallett, thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by UK-US-EU armed genocide. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.